The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And many of you who listen regularly to Armchair Traveler probably are among those who love going to the beach, right? Well, on today's episode, we're going to hear from some people who love going beneath the ocean surface to explore life in a world that continues to amaze us as technology opens up the vast expanse of water that covers more than 70% of our planet. First, we go 28 days under the sea. This was written by Liron Ballesta and appears in the May 2021 Ocean issue of National Geographic magazine. Ballesta is also a photographer and biologist. As the editors explain, he has dived among frenzied sharks in Polynesia, under ice in Antarctica, and with coelacanths off South Africa. In his article, Ballesta joins three other explorers who spend a month in a tiny capsule and dived on the floor of the Mediterranean. And there they found some amazing sea life and signs of our impact on a mysterious landscape. So let's begin. I grew up along the Mediterranean coast in the south of France. My first swimming, snorkeling, and scuba diving took place on the Riviera. As time passed and the Mediterranean became my professional home base, I watched this torrentially visited coast be ravaged by unbridled development. And I also saw, at depths of more than 150 feet or so, worlds that still seemed intact. Until recently, however, I'd gotten only brief glimpses of them. When you're scuba diving, it takes 4 to 6 hours just to ascend from such depths. You have to decompress slowly to avoid dying from the bends. So time on the bottom is frustratingly short, usually only 5 or 10 minutes. In July 2019, we changed that. For 28 straight days, my four-man team dived, or rather lived, in a cramped, pressurized habitat on a barge in the Mediterranean, breathing a high-pressure mix of helium and oxygen, descending to the seafloor each day in a diving bell. We worked like saturation divers in the offshore oil industry, but unlike such divers who typically are tethered to a bell by an umbilical, we put on scuba gear with rebreathers that filtered carbon dioxide from our exhalations. That meant we could explore the bottom freely for hours, not minutes. Because both the bell and the habitat and the bathroom in between were kept at the same high pressure as the seafloor, as much as 13 times surface pressure, we didn't have to decompress each time we ascended. Instead, we decompressed just once at the end of the mission for nearly 5 days before opening the heavy metal hatch of our capsule and breathing the open air once again. On July 1, 2019, off Marseille, that hatch changed shut behind us after we entered the diving bell, or clanged shut, I should say. Mispronounced that word, I'm sorry. The hatch clanged shut behind us after we entered the diving bell, all geared up in our red suits for our first elevator ride down. It felt as if we were in a vessel taking us to the moon. At the seafloor, as we exited through a bottom airlock and swam away, the feeling was incredible. We were deep water aquanauts, leaving our link to home. I took a look back at the bell, fading in the blue. On that first dive, around 226 feet down, we kept it in sight. Humans have crisscrossed the Mediterranean for millennia, but the bottom is a world even less known than our well-mapped moon, and unlike the moon, it's full of life. We wandered slowly, without a hurry, and Kolanska National Park, where Jacques Cousteau and Louis Malle came into the 1950s to make A Silent World, a film that introduced a generation to undersea life. On that first dive, we saw an animal I'd seen only once before, a decade earlier, for an instant, the veined squid. A pair of them were mating right in front of us. The male passed under the female, and their tentacles intertwined. The male slipped his lower arm, which carries the sperm, under the female's mantle. Seconds later, the female swam into a small cave and hung along clusters of fertilized eggs from the ceiling. These squid live only 3 years or so and get just one chance to reproduce, once in a lifetime, and we were there. As far as I know, the behavior had never been documented before. For our first day, it seemed a good omen. In the 1960s, Cousteau pioneered the use of seafloor habitats along the same coast, living on the bottom for weeks at a time. We had a great advantage. We weren't tied to one spot. In 28 days, our barge, towed slowly by a tugboat, traveled more than 350 miles, from Marseille to Monaco and back. We dived in 21 places. In our 55-square-foot habitat, the four of us, Yannick Gentil, Thibault Ruby, and Antonin Gilbert, and I were voluntary prisoners. There we rested, ate meals, passed through a small airlock by the crew on deck, and waited for the next dive. The dives were our escape. Every day we endured violent contrast, from the stifling heat in the cramped steel container to the bone-chilling immensity of the depths, from mind-numbing inaction to vital vigilance, from desperation and depression to ecstasy and euphoria. At the end of each day, we were exhausted, and we couldn't wait to do it all over again. The mix gas mix we breathed, 97% helium and 3% oxygen, prevented nitrogen narcosis and epileptic convulsions at death. But it turned our voices into high-pitched, almost incomprehensible quacking, forcing us to communicate through microphones and software that adjusted the soundtrack to almost normal. The helium had another curious side effect. It's such a good heat conductor that it chilled us from the inside, draining our body heat with each breath. I have dived deep under the ice in Antarctica in water that was below freezing, but I felt much colder here in my home sea, where even at a depth temperature was a steady 57 degrees Fahrenheit. We picked places to explore that we knew to be beautiful and flourishing. Coral reefs are rare in the Mediterranean. What it has instead, at depths between 230 and 400 feet, are coralliginous reefs built by red algae. They secrete hard calcium carbonate foundations that are reinforced by some animals, worms, mollusks, corals, and gnawed at by others, such as sponges. The constant struggle creates a textured world of nooks and crannies in which more than 1,650 species can find their niche. Sparkling pink swallowtail perch are abundant, but I waited years to see this far more elusive cousin, the parrot sea perch, which is slenderer, with a larger eye and a distinctive tail. Off Le Vendeau, I made what might be the first photograph of this little fish live. Things like that convinced me there was a point to all this crazy effort. The photographs here show just some of the creatures we met in 4 weeks, at depths as great as 466 feet. We saw strange shapes, bizarre attitudes, deceitful intentions. We saw a Gorgon cephalid, for example, named after the Gorgons of Greek myth, who had hair of coiled serpents and the power to petrify those who looked at them. This basket star is harmless, barely 4 inches in diameter when coiled, but as I watched, it slowly unfurled its endlessly branching arms to 10 times that width. When these bewitching creatures meet, they often intertwine these arms in delicate caresses. Why? Well, that remains a mystery, because like sea stars, they reproduce at a distance without touching, discharging their gametes into the current. At 466 feet, only 1% of the sun's light penetrates the gloom, but there are no longer any plankton either, so the water is clear, and even in the gloom, it is possible to see and photograph vast spaces. Just off Villefranche-sur-Mer, where the Alps extend into the Mediterranean and the seafloor drops off steeply, I was suddenly afforded views like a mountaineer unto another earth right next to our own. Those two worlds are connected. The seafloor mud we sampled contained pesticides, hydrocarbons, carcinogenic PCBs. Surface waters were alive with noise and human activity. Fleeing such pressure, the large animals we met, monstrous monkfish, dragon-like congers, tank-like lobsters, all seemed to have retreated to greater depths. There, the Mediterranean is still alive. Its heart is still beating. But what sort of future will we offer it? And that's quite interesting, and hopefully we can return and take a look at some of these photographs a little later in the program. Well, next, writer Rachel Hartigan is going to explore the life of a famous ocean explorer. I'm sure you've heard of this fellow. Her article, The Searcher of the Deep, appeared in the May 2021 issue of National Geographic. And as the opening photo caption states, Robert Ballard may be best known for finding the Titanic, but his hunt for scientific and cultural treasures is a lifelong expedition. So let's go meet Mr. Ballard and some of his cohorts in this article. If the plane was in there, it would have seen it, says Robert Ballard, referring to the 14-foot autonomous surface vehicle, also known as an ASV, launched from his 211-foot exploration vehicle, the EV Nautilus. He is sitting in his cabin on the Nautilus, gesturing at a map of the seafloor on his computer screen. The ASV, a remote-controlled boat equipped with multi-beam sonar, had generated the underwater image as it skirted the reef surrounding Nukumaru Maruo, the remote Pacific island where Ballard was searching for Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra 10E. More than four decades after discovering hydrothermal vents and black smokers on the seafloor, three decades after finding the Titanic, and nearly 20 years after locating John F. Kennedy's World War II patrol boat, the 78-year-old National Geographic Explorer-at-Large is still in the business of solving the ocean's great mysteries. Earhart, who disappeared while trying to become the first person to fly around the world at the equator, has been missing for more than eight decades. Before this expedition in 2019, Ballard had announced that if her plane was there, he would find it. "We did the whole enchilada," he says, over the thrum of the Nautilus's motors as the ship navigates away from the island. He's uncharacteristically subdued after an intensive period of late-night watches and eye-straining examinations of sonar backscatter and underwater video footage, but he soon spins in his chair to explain the images on his screen. Above Ballard's desk is an illustration from the Jules Verne 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea of a giant squid battling humans. To his left, a TV monitor linked to the remotely operated vehicles, or ROVs, that he helped design, and they serve as his porthole into the ocean's depths. Ballard conducted the search for Earhart's plane with his usual relentlessness, focusing his attention on the northwestern edge of the 4.7-mile-long island, where a 1937 photograph showed what looked like an Electra's landing gear jutting from the reef. Drones aimed their cameras at the surf breaking over the reef. The ASV surveyed the water down to 754 feet, and the ROVs Hercules and Argus inspected the jagged slopes nearly 5,000 feet down to the ocean floor. The Nautilus, with its multi-beam sonar, circumnavigated the island five times. The ASV did so three times and the drones once. Ballard and his crew watched it all from the ship's monitors. They didn't find Earhart's plane. "We gave it a hell of a shot," says Ballard, pointing out that his discovery of the Titanic in 1985 was the third attempt by searchers to locate the ocean liner, and that it took him two expeditions to find the Bismarck, the Nazis' largest battleship, in 1989. "Sometimes I get it right off the top," he says. "Sometimes it takes..." Well, he shifts gears. "I learned a lot," he continues. "I was eliminating possibilities. It was fun." Ballard doesn't let setbacks or anything else really slow him down. But after 157 expeditions, the man who introduced the public to deep water exploration is taking stock. This spring, he's publishing a memoir and releasing a documentary, both with National Geographic. His team at the Ocean Exploration Trust has funding through next decade, whether he's at the helm or not. "I've started divesting my world," he says. "I'm letting my brain loose, which is scary." When Ballard was 12, he saw the movie 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, in which the mysterious Captain Nemo roves the waves in an opulent submarine called the Nautilus. "It just captivated me," he says, although Ballard spent his childhood in Southern California beachcombing, fishing, and body surfing. It had never occurred to him that there was an entire world under the ocean surface. He told his parents that when he grew up, he wanted to be Captain Nemo. But the path from dream to reality wasn't smooth. The middle child of an aviation engineer and a brilliant housewife, Ballard struggled in school. He found reading and writing difficult. Homework took him twice as long as it did his older brother Richard, who sailed through school and eventually earned a doctorate in physics. His sister Nancy Ann had a genetic mutation that required her to be cared for all her life. Once Ballard locked on to becoming an oceanographer, a real-life Captain Nemo, he had a purpose. "I just knew that the only way I could overcome things was to be dogged," he says. He did well at the University of California, Santa Barbara, but did not do well enough to get into graduate school at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, which he had been gunning for since he was a kid. Salvation came in the form of the Army Reserve Officers Training Corps, which he joined as an undergraduate. When it was time for active service, he requested a transfer to the Navy. He received it, along with orders to move to Massachusetts to serve as a liaison with the research organizations such as the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Somehow, he writes in his memoir, "I ended up in the perfect place." "The sub is now falling peacefully toward the rift floor 9,000 feet below us," Ballard wrote in his first article for National Geographic, which ran in the May 1975 issue. Ballard was describing his ascent in Alvin, the cramped submersible operated by Woods Hole during Project Famous. This French-American expedition was the first to explore the Mid-Atlantic Range, the longest mountain range on the planet. One of 10 scientists involved in the adventure, Ballard witnessed with his own eyes the evidence for plate tectonics, which was then a controversial theory. Ballard was also preferred seeing direct visual observation, as he puts it, to theorizing, and Alvin was the perfect tool for the science he wanted to do. The only submersible operated by a U.S. oceanic institution, Alvin could go as deep as 12,000 feet. If Ballard wanted to explore deep water, he needed to stick with Woods Hole and its little white sub. After he left the Navy, he got a Ph.D. at the University of Rhode Island and joined the Woods Hole as a research scientist. Ballard's visual approach to science would open up new worlds. In 1977, he joined an expedition north of the Galapagos, where he previously collected samples indicated puzzling amounts of hot water. He brought Alvin and a new tool called Angus, a tethered sled lugging three cameras that could go as deep as 20,000 feet. The team discovered hydrothermal vents, cracks in the ocean floor that released scalding water. They also came across life where they least expected to find it, nearly 9,000 feet deep and in total darkness. Enormous clams, massive mussels, giant tube worms all flourishing near vents in the earth spewing hydrogen sulfide. The creatures lived off the malodorous gas through a previously unknown process called chemosynthesis, which Ballard and his team didn't realize existed until they saw the evidence firsthand. Ballard set about trying to figure out how to predict where hydrothermal vents might appear. In the process, he discovered another unknown phenomenon. On an expedition off Baja California, his team encountered what appeared to be underwater chimneys billowing black smoke. The water near these structures was so hot it melted the tip of Alvin's thermometer. The chimneys were constructed of polymetallic sulfides. The minerals had precipitated when they hit the cold water, and their composition revealed that enormous amounts of water cycled through the ocean floor. Ballard's discoveries were groundbreaking, but crude submersibles had definite disadvantages. For one, the long commute time to the ocean bottom and back didn't leave much time for exploring. More crucially, they could be dangerous. During the famous Project Famous, a fire broke out on a French submersible with Ballard aboard, and Alvin got stuck in a fissure. On a mission to the Cayman Trough, he was in a Navy bathscape that hit a rock wall, rupturing a gas line or gas tank. It took 6 hours for the vessel to return to the surface. The crew weren't sure they'd make it until they saw the sky. Ballard began to wonder if camera-wielding robots would be better for this job. In 1977, Ballard decided to take on the Titanic, but his first attempt was nearly catastrophic. Instead of submersibles, he was using pipes, 3,000 feet of them, lowered to the ocean floor from a derrick on a ship called the Sea Probe. A pod containing $600,000 worth of borrowed sonar camera equipment dangled from the bottommost pipe. But before Ballard could even begin looking for the luxury liner, the entire structure collapsed in the middle of the night. Derrick, pipes, borrowed equipment, most of it ending up in the bottom of the Atlantic. He wasn't daunted finding the Titanic was the Everest of ocean exploration, the number one quest on everyone's list, he writes. He was too competitive and too ambitious to give up. Again, the military opened the door. The Navy would fund Ballard's development of ROVs if it could have access to them, and to Ballard's expertise for certain secret missions. The first ROV developed was Argo, which transmitted live video, allowing scientists to make immediate decisions about where to explore. To the Navy, it seemed like an excellent tool for examining the wreckage of the two nuclear submarines, the Thresher and the Scorpion, in the North Atlantic. To Ballard, those missions, which were kept secret until the late 1990s, would serve as a perfect jumping-off point for the Titanic. The admirals agreed to give him 2 weeks to search, as long as he first recorded the condition of the Scorpion to their satisfaction. Ballard's work on the submarines proved crucial to his discovery of the Titanic. The Thresher expedition in 1984 and the Scorpion in 1985 taught him how wreckage scattered underwater. Heavier objects fall directly to the ocean floor, while currents carry lighter items farther away, creating a debris field shaped like a comet. Because time was tight and a team funded by a Texas oil man was hot on the Titanic's trail, Ballard partnered with a French group, which scanned the search area with a sophisticated sonar system. Ballard assumed the French would find the ship first, and he would come afterward to provide visuals. But the French didn't find it. Ballard set up a search grid for Argo based on his estimate of the size of the Titanic's debris field. Then his team began what he calls mowing the lawn, traversing the grid back and forth, back and forth. It's tedious work until you find something. At about 1 a.m. on September 1, 1985, they did. A boiler nestled amid debris. Public response to the discovery was immediate and overwhelming. Ballard had become, to his joy and chagrin, the man who found the Titanic, a moniker that would eclipse even the most significant of his scientific discoveries. Even so, the publicity fanned a flame in Ballard that had first been sparked by an encounter with National Geographic Society President Melvor Grosvenor at a Boston diving club in 1972. Grosvenor suggested that he write for the magazine. Ballard had taken scientists down to see the wonders of the deep ocean. He thought the public should be able to witness them, too. Ballard had begun inviting reporters and photographers on his expeditions early in his career, and he'd participated in several National Geographic television specials about his work, drawing some scorn from academic colleagues. The barb stung, but Ballard stuck to his outreach. Now he wanted to reach children, thousands of whom had sent him letters after he discovered the Titanic. Perhaps he could guide their fascination towards science and exploration. Plus, he says, if you can't tell a 5-year-old what you're doing, you don't know what you're doing. This mission became more vital to him after tragedy struck. Ballard had married Marjorie Hargis in 1966, and they had 2 sons, Todd and Douglas. The marriage became strained over the years, but Ballard took great joy in his boys. As soon as they were old enough, he began bringing them on expeditions, beginning with Todd, the eldest. Todd was with Ballard on the first hunt for the Bismarck when they didn't find the Nazi battleship, and he was with his father on the second try in June 1989 when they did. But 3 months later, Todd, not yet 21, was killed in a car crash. Ballard's marriage ended soon after. A shattered Ballard threw himself into the Jason Project, which had launched that year and featured live broadcast to students from an archaeology expedition in the Mediterranean with footage provided by Jason, his newest ROV. Soon he'd schedule a second Jason expedition to Lake Ontario and a third to the Galapagos. National Geographic was a partner in the project. The Society's point person was a young woman named Barbara Earle. In 1991, Earle and Ballard married. Their children, Benjamin and Emily, would join their father on his expeditions. Ballard was now fully in the business of finding things and taking the public along with him on his journeys. In the Mediterranean, he identified an ancient trade route by the amphorae that littered the seabed, and he discovered a Phoenician ship. In the Black Sea, he found a fully preserved ancient ship and evidence of a Noah-like flood. In the Pacific, he located the USS Yorktown and Kennedy's PT-109, wreckage from World War II battles. He was roaming the world just as Captain Nemo did. Now all he needed was his very own Nautilus. He tried to buy an East German research vessel that appeared to have been outfitted as a spy ship. When he couldn't afford the asking price, the owner, New York billionaire Vincent Viola, gave it to him. Enamored by Lewis and Clark's core of discovery, Ballard created a core of exploration, the team that would operate the Nautilus's technological tools on expeditions around the world. Ballard emulated Lewis and Clark in another way, too. As it did with the 19th century explorers, the U.S. government asked Ballard to map United States territory, the Exclusive Economic Zone, EEZ, that extends 200 miles along the country's shores. That's what brought Ballard to Nikumaruo in 2019. The Nautilus was mapping the EEZ around the American Samoa and Howland Islands, the unincorporated territory where Earhart had intended to land in 1937. The EEZ assignment also had allowed Ballard to pursue a project along the California shore looking for underwater caves that may hold signs of the first humans who traveled down the coastline. But Ballard's most compelling quest these days may be to understand himself. Throughout his life, he wondered why his brain seemed to work so differently from other people's. Although he's the author of 26 books and more than 150 scholarly and popular articles, reading and writing remain a struggle. Then in March 2015, he heard a radio interview with the authors of a book about dyslexia. He ordered the book and read it in one sitting, crying when he was done, he says, because it explained me to me. He realized that he'd created a world in which he could flourish, one that requires spatial thinking or visualizing in three dimensions. He can stand in the middle of his ship's command center and transform its dozens of displays into a single image in his mind. During his first dive in Alvin to the Titanic, the submersible lost its sonar, but Ballard still knew where to go. The ocean is a world of total darkness, and it's not dark to me, Ballard says. I see it. What an impressive fellow Robert Ballard is, isn't he? Interesting story there. Well, let's get back to some thoughts here I want to share before we have to wrap it up. These are some captions from photographs taken by Laurent Ballesta during his one-month underwater exploration of the Mediterranean aboard that tiny capsule and with three other divers, as we read earlier. And they accompanied his article, 28 Days Under the Sea. And this, again, is from the May 2021 issue of National Geographic. And we'll just read a couple of these. The Mediterranean Sea, he says, is nearly enclosed by land, an underwater realm that has little exchange with the Atlantic and has largely unexplored seafloor. For nearly a month, Laurent Ballesta and his team lived in pressurized container on a barge that was towed over 350 miles from Marseille to Monaco and back. They dived in 21 locations at depths of up to 466 feet. At 256 feet, they found throughout the North Atlantic and Mediterranean the site of a jellyfish, Pelagia nautiluxia, a.k.a. the mauve stinger. Stinging cells cover its tentacles and entire body, but the sting of a black coral has paralyzed this one, and this was off the coast. And then at 256 feet, they found also, scattering some of its scarfs, a red scorpionfish feeding on a narwhal shrimp on a reef off Marseille. Coralligeneous reefs built by red algae and other species are part of the deep Mediterranean's biodiversity hotspots. And that, my friend, is going to bring us to the end of today's Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions, direct them please to 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.